hope you had a nice weekend. Maybe I went a bit, well, plausibly I went a bit fast at the end of last lecture to finish discussing the relation between Wilson normalization group and the perturbative normalization group. So feel free to come and ask questions if you have some in the afternoon. I am in my office. But we have to go on if I want to treat gauge theories this last week. And so let's go on. And today I'm going to discuss how path integral quantization we see can be adapted to deal with fermions, which of course is going to be useful both for high energy physics and for condensed matter. And I think you are going to use these techniques, these calculational techniques, this week for the condensed matter course. So, first, I'm going to explain why, in fact, you have to change the rule of to build a functional integral by using some number which do not commute, because fermionic fields anti-commute. So I'm going to explain what a theory of Grassmann algebras and Bérezin calculus. Bérezin was a mathematician, a Russian mathematician and mathematical physicist who basically at the basis of this formalism. And then I'm going to apply this quickly without making any real calculation, but show how this works for the Dirac field. So the Dirac field in relativistic fermionic field, spin 1/2 field in QED. Okay, so first, Grassmann algebra. So the problem is that, well, the question is that, of course, as you know, in relativistic quantum mechanics and in relativistic high energy physics, you have fermions, spin 1/2 or half integer spin particles or fields, and they obey the Fermi-Dirac statistic. So in order to represent these statistics, they have to anti-commute instead of commuting. So in a path integral formalism for bosons, like for instance for the scalar field, where the spin is zero, then we have a correspondence rule between the field operator in canonical quantization and the random variable in path integral quantization. We can identify easily that each time that we compute something that contains this random variable, we more or less compute some matrix element of the field operator. So that's the correspondence rule. And the problem is that for spin 1/2 particles, we have fermion field operator or Dirac wave functions, which are spinors. And the question is, which kind of random variable would they correspond to in a path integral formulation? And so, because they have to somehow anti-commute instead of commuting. Here they commute. This is commuting. Here, what it is. Okay. So the solution to this problem, which of course was invented before or at the same time, but independently of that, is using algebras of number, which are not really real numbers, but algebras whose element anti-commute. And they are called Grassmann algebra. So I'm going to introduce a complex Grassmann algebras, so which they are more general theory with real or material, but I'm going to introduce what I call the Grassmann algebra algebra that I'm going to call, to denote it Gn. So Gn is the algebra, it's not a group, which is an algebra over a number field. So there is a general theory, but I'm considering the field of complex number in this case. So I'm going to consider a complex Grassmann algebra, but you can do it for other fields, in particular the field of real number. Well, if it's real, then K is going to be R. And this is useful for Weyl fermions and fermions with no charge, but okay. Okay, so let me describe it in an abstract term. So this is an algebra over a field C, which it is generated by pairs of elements that I'm going to call theta I and theta bar I, where I goes to 1 to n. So I'm going to consider a finite dimensional algebra. So these elements are the generators. So we have 2n generators. But they are grouped in this way because in some sense that we are going to define, this is the complex conjugate of this generator. Okay. And the point is that this abstract element of the algebra are not numbers, they are not matrices, they are some different objects, they are just defined by the relation. And the basic relation is that they anticommute. The thetas anticommutes instead of commuting. So we have that theta I times theta G, the anticommutator, which is theta I theta G plus theta G times theta I, is zero, and the same for thetas and theta bars, the same for theta bars and theta, which is of course the same, and the same for theta bars and theta bar. So each time you have two thetas in a product, the anticommute. Okay. So in particular, this implies that the thetas are nilpotent, which means that any theta anticommutes with itself. So any theta I squared is zero, and any theta bar squared is zero. Okay. Okay, so those generators anticommute. Okay. So these are the sets of generators. So now, this is an algebra over C, so it means that it contains the unity. And it is the algebra, the Boole algebra, is generated by all the sets, the linear combination of products of the generators. The definition of an algebra. And modulo those anticommutation rules. So now, what is so these are the generators. Okay, and now this is the first step in the definition. And now the second step is to consider what is a general element. That's the algebra. So a general element of the algebra, let's call it G, little g, that belongs to this big algebra G with n pairs of generator, is just, can be written as a sum of products of thetas and theta bars. sum of thetas and theta bars times complex coefficient. Okay? That's the definition of the algebra. But the products of thetas and theta bars, thetas and theta bars, they are not all independent because you can use the anti-commutation relation. So you see that if you have a product of thetas and theta bars using the anti-commutation relation, you can always move the thetas to the left, for instance, move the theta bars to the right. Well, this is my move the thetas to the left, the theta bar to the right, and order them in some arbitrary way. Okay. So since we have this I generator, we can just order theta out. So let me give an example first, before giving the general relation. Example. Very simple example. It's a Grassmann algebra with one pair of generators. So it has three elements. First, you can write A times the identity that I'm going to omit generally. That is just one, it's a pure number. Then you have, so let's call it A. This is the identity. Then we have theta, so we can write B. Then we have theta bars. And then we have theta bars. And we can, when we have a product of theta and theta bar using, we can choose that theta is to the left of theta bar. That's just a convention. So the A, B, C, D are complex numbers. Complex numbers. Okay, so you see that. And now when you have a product of two elements, you just take the product and reorganize the theta. Oh, of course, something as I've not specified is that this algebra is associative. That's crucial. Associative means that the products of, you have seen that, presume, but associativity in is that AB times C, well, let's say, not coefficient, but real coefficient. So let me G1 times G2 times G3 is the same thing that G1 times G2 times G3. So it can be denoted G1, G2, G3 without any ambiguity. Okay. And all the algebra that one meets in quantum physics, quantum mechanics, are associative. That's one of the crucial properties of the mathematical formalism of quantum mechanics. There have been attempts since the very beginning of quantum mechanics to build a quantum theory out of non-associative algebra, but nothing convincing, I think, came out of this. But still. Okay, so this is the example. And the general general case for an n-dimensional algebra is that you can set a set that I'm going to call I, which is a set of indices i1 less than i2 less than up to ik. Okay, of indices, where all the i's are between 1 and n. Okay, the number of generators. I define a set G, let's say, which is a set of G1 less than G2 less than GH. I'm sorry, it doesn't have to be the same number. Okay. With all the IAs and all the IB are between 1, I'm sorry, and N, that And then to each of these ordered families, we associate an element, a coefficient Cij, which is a complex number. Okay. And we write g as a sum of all the possible I and all the possible g of c, the coefficient ci, capital I, capital g, times the order product of the thetas. So I write the theta I1 times theta I2 up to theta ik times theta bar I G1, I'm sorry, this is G1 up to theta bar GK. Okay. And you see the K, which is a number of element of I, and G, which is a number of element, H, I'm sorry, which is a number of element of the set G, are arbitrary. So they can go from zero, which means that you just have no thetas and no theta bars. So the element proportional to the identity is contained in this. But they cannot go be larger than n. Because if you have a product of n plus one thetas, then you have at least two thetas which are equal. And if they are equal, the product is zero. So from this, it's easy to convince yourself that the dimension of this Grassmann complex algebra, so the number of independent elements is 4 to the power n. The complex dimension of this algebra, okay? Okay. Okay, so that's the first general element. Okay. Now there is an additional operation that I'm going to set on this Grassmann algebra, which is I'm going to add a conjugation. So I'm going to call this a star operation, which is going to be the analog for those Grassmann algebra of the operation of Hermitian conjugation in quantum mechanics or operator. Okay. So this conjugation operator is the same, will obey what you expect to in the ordinary algebra of matrices. So similar to the complex conjugation operation for matrices. We are going to need it. Okay. So the operation is that if we have such a coefficient, for instance, a coefficient which is a complex number, okay, we have a complex number. Let's call it little c. C star is just the complex conjugate of C. Okay. For generators, the thetas and the theta bars. So the conjugate of any generator is going to be the theta corresponding theta bars, And the conjugate of the theta bar is going to be the theta. Okay? It's the same to expect. And finally, for products of elements, in the algebra, any general elements, then we are going to assume, that's the definition, that if G1 and G2 belongs to our big algebra, then the conjugate of the product of G1 and G2 is the product, the inverse product of the conjugate, with G2 star times G1 star. Okay. As for matrices. Where? Because the Hermitian conjugation of matrices contains a transposition, you have to invert. Okay, so these are the three properties. Okay. And out of this, it's easy to see that what is the conjugate of a general element G? Is going to be the conjugate of the sum over the I, the conjugate of the C's and the C bar. But then you have to invert and take the conjugate of all the products. So instead of that, you are going to have theta G1 times theta G. You are going to have theta GKs and times theta GK minus 1, ta 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 ta, up to theta G1. And then you are going to have theta bar IK up to theta bar I1. So it's no basis. So it changes the order. Okay? Okay, so that's the three basic objects we need. Okay. We need the generator, the anti-commuting relation between generators, the definition of the general element, and then this conjugation operation, which is going to be important in the following. Okay. So you can see from this definition, for instance, that if you have two products, if you have a product of two generators, it acts like an ordinary real element. It commutes with the elements. Okay. So now, so this is an algebraic definition. So we have a set of generalized numbers, which are those the object, and we have rules of multiplication, and of course we have a rule of addition. So the addition is the ordinary addition, and the multiplication is given by these rules. So they form an algebra. Okay. So now we are going to make some functional calculus. With this Grassmann algebra. Okay. Since they play the role of real or complex number, we're going to need to define what is an integral over complex number, Grassmann algebra. Okay. So I'm going to give here a very abstract definition. Abstract definition or formalism, but That's the one that we need. That's the one which is going to work. Okay? So first, you see that since a general element can be viewed as a linear combination with complex coefficient of products and the thetas and the theta bars, you may think of this as the general series expansion or Taylor expansion of a function in the thetas and the theta bars. So if the thetas and the theta bars were just complex variable, it would be the first term of the general series expansion of a function in complex number. But simply here, since the complex number z and z bar, you see, anti-commutes, the Taylor expansion ends at some finite order, because then the next coefficients are automatically zero. You can view this. One can think as G, an element of the algebra, as a function of the generator, the theta i's and theta bar i's. But you shouldn't push this analogy too far, but you can think of it, right, and try to integrate. Okay. So first, I'm going to define an operation of derivation. With respect to theta, the thetas and the theta bars. So if I have an element and I view it as a function of the thetas and the theta bars, then I derive this object with respect to theta. For ordinary derivation, when you have one theta, you take it down. When you have two theta, it's like two times theta, et cetera, et cetera. But here you never have the same theta twice. Okay? So I'm going to define the derivation with respect to theta i's. So I'm using the ordinary definition. I define d over theta I of 1 to be 0. If there is no here, I'm going to define d over d theta I of theta I equal 1. That's the ordinary term. Okay. I'm going to assume then the anti-commuting relation of Leibniz rules, which when you have a product of thetas, how do I apply? And the rule is that since the theta bar are the thetas are anti-commuting, if I want to compute d over d theta high of a product of thetas, and then I have the theta high, this is that first move the theta i's to the left, this theta i's. Use anti-commutation relation to move it to the left. And then apply the above rule. So you move it to the left, and then you remove it by this rule. Oh, and of course, I assume the theta over theta I over all the other theta g for g different from I, g different from I, and d over d theta I of any theta bar g is 0. So the only difference with ordinary numbers is this one, because this, you use the anti-commutation relations. Yeah. And now same for d over d theta bar I. D theta bar of 1 is 0, d over d theta bar I of theta bar. And we can write this and this into d over d theta bar I of theta bar g equal delta I g, and d over d theta bar I times theta g is 0. Whatever I and g, okay? Yeah, this and this can be rewritten also as a delta ig. Okay, is it clear? Good. An example. Example. For this G, d over d theta of this G example n equal 1, let's say G1 of G n equal 1 is obviously B plus D theta, but d over d theta bar of my g for n equal 1, this is c, but then if I want to take the derivative with respect to theta bar, I first have to anti-commute them and then take the derivation, so this is c, I'm sorry, this is d theta bar, c minus d times theta. Of course, here this is theta bar because I have get rid of the theta. Okay. So here theta has disappeared and here theta bar has disappeared. Okay. So now I want to define an integration operation. So this is a derivation. An integration. So I want to integrate over some theta I or theta bar I. So when you integrate over a function of some variable, this variable disappears because it became a dummy variable you integrate over. So the integration, integrating over some theta I of some element of the algebra, should give another element of the algebra where the theta I corresponding has disappeared. But that's already what is doing the derivation operation. Okay? And in fact, there is a very nice simplification of the integration. Because basically, we want that that this integration over d theta I, when we integrate a derivative of an element, we want it to be just apply the rule of partial integration and rewrite this as a boundary integral. A boundary term. But there are no boundary in this abstract case. So we want that this is always equal to zero. We want this. This is a rule of partial integration, integrating partial derivative. But you can show that the property of this, since any derivation you know, get rid of one theta, if you apply two derivatives, it's automatically zero. Okay. So in fact, the solution is very simple. identify integration with derivation. This, of course, doesn't work for complex ordinary number, but it turns out that it has all the property of an integration for this anti-commuting number. So solution takes that integral over d theta I equal d over d theta I. And of course, integration over d theta bar I is the same thing by definition over d theta bar I. Okay, so this is the most mysterious part of the recipe. See, this is a definition which is natural but analogous to what's going on for ordinary numbers, and this is new. But it works. Okay. Yes?
Can you repeat, please, again, why we want the first thing to go to zero?
Well, that's what we are going to need in for our calculation. But that's a natural, something natural. I just wanted to justify this. Okay. Then you can check that with this definition, this property is automatically satisfied. Because you can check that in the same way that thetas and theta bars anti-commute, those operations anti-commute. So one has to be careful, a bit careful. But let me just write this property. Properties the derivation anti-commutes. So you can check that if you have d over theta I and you take d over theta g, you take the anticommutator of this, this is equal to zero, etc. So you have to pay attention to in which order you apply differentiation, and you have to pay attention in which order you apply integration operation. So, warning, beware of the order of operation in your algebra. Both multiplications, derivation and integration. Only addition commutes. The other operation anti-commutes. Okay. Okay. So with this definition, you can check that, for instance, that when you integrate a constant function, which in general gives you a number, in this case, if we integrate an element that is proportional to one, this gives zero. Warning, another warnings. Taking the derivative of just a complex number zero, but integrating a complex number, complex function, if you like, gives also zero. Okay. So the fact that they anti-commute and you have this operation means also that, of course, the theta i's are generators. So you may look at change of basis of the algebra. You can have different basis or change of basis for the algebra. Basis for your algebra. So if you have a set of generators, which is theta i's and the theta bar i's, this is a set of generators, and you get to another set of generators, which I'm going to call them, well, this is written in the notes. Let me call them var theta, because there is a Greek character which is var theta I and var theta G. Bar I, which are linear combination of those ones. So we can write that var theta I is some matrix GIG times theta G. And then var theta I is the complex conjugate theta bar G with G. GIG, some complex matrix. So it's just a linear change of variables, a basis. Then the rules of integration and of derivation are slightly different. Instead of having Jacobians, you have inverse of Jacobians. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The derivation changes as usual, so you can check that if you take the derivative with respect to the new variable of an element, this is the inverse of the Jacobian matrix IG times D over D theta I, G, was the usual Jacobian rule for derivation. Okay. But for integration, since integration are the same thing as derivation, instead of having that the integral is given by the change of variables, you have the square of the determinant of the Jacobians. You have the square of the determinant of the inverse of the Jacobians. You get a determinant minus one instead of a determinant of the Jacobian. But we are going to see that this is a general rule. Okay, so now let me just show what is the most important property which I'm going to use of all this very abstract formalism. Can we perform Gaussian integration with those Grassmann variables? So, I'm going to consider, so remember, I have this algebra Gn, which has 2n generators, and I want to define the integral over d theta 1 up to, I'm going to write this in this way. I'm going to write the product over the d bar theta 1 up to d bar theta n times d theta 1 times d theta n. Okay, this is going to be a multi-dimensional integration of an element g. So this is a multi-dimensional. This means that I make first this integral, then this, and then this one to this one. And, I'm sorry. It's the order. I'm going d theta bar 1 d theta 1 times d theta bar n times d theta n. That's in this order that I'm making the calculation. If I change the order, there is just a sign. And then I want to define what is the exponential of minus theta bar I aig times theta g, okay, where aig are the elements of a complex positive, well, it doesn't have to be positive, but complex Hermitian matrix. Okay. So this I'm going to denote just by definition. I'm going to define this as denote this as d theta bar times d theta times exponential minus theta bar times the matrix A times theta. Oh, so that's just a shorthand notation. See, so theta bar is just the sets of theta bar 1 up to theta bar n. It's a vector, and theta is the vector. Okay, so that's a shortened notation. Okay. So, well, how do you compute this Gaussian integral, this Gaussian Grassmann integral? Well, we just write the exponential, how to compute. First, how do we define the exponential? Well, we defined exponential of this. So this is an element of the algebra that contains just a sum of products of theta bars and theta. Now, define this as, as usual, sum from k equals 0 to infinity of 1 over factorial k times the products of minus theta bars a theta to the power k. And then used my rules of calculation to reorganize this product by putting all the thetas to the left and all the theta bars to the right. Okay? Well, it's easy to see that here only the terms of up to n survives by the same argument. If you have a product of k larger than n of theta bars and theta, you are going to find in any subterms, subproducts, at least two times the same theta and the same theta bar. And that's going to vanish. So in fact, now this is a polynomial. Instead of being an infinite series. Okay, and then we apply the rule of integration. Okay? And so we have this is going to be a big sum of products of k. And if we apply the rules of integration, only k equal n survive, because all the first terms contains less theta and less theta bars that we are integrating over. So we have to integrate some over thetas on a term that doesn't contain it. And from this rule, which said that integrating over theta is the same as integrating over derivative and derivative 1, 0, they vanish. See? This rule. So we get finally a sum, and then we integrate over all the thetas and all the theta bars. All the thetas and all the theta bars disappear, and it remains just a sum of products of n matrix elements of A. And all the indices have to be different. And there is a minus sign each time that you make a commutation of the index in order to ordering them. So end of the calculation. We get the sum of products of element of Aij, where all the line elements and all the row elements are different, with a sign, which corresponds in fact to the signature of the permutation. So what we get is that this big integral, I, let's call it I, so it's a, so this integral, of course, is a complex number because we get rid of all the thetas of all the theta bars, and this integral is just the determinant of the matrix A. Okay? That's a beautiful result. So I like to emphasize this. So basically, all this big, bit complicated and abstract formalism is the way to write the determinant of a matrix as the result of a Gaussian integration over the exponential of a quadratic form associated to this matrix, but a quadratic form involving anti-commuting numbers instead of commuting one. You see? So, so what is the difference between what we did here and what one is doing when doing general integration? So if you had, you know, for if you have a complex, ordinary complex numbers, so you have a vector z, which is a collection of z1 up to zn, and z bar equal z bar 1 up to z bar n, and you integrate over all the z's and all the z bars of exponential of minus z bar times the matrix z. These are complex numbers. So in fact, you have 2n real numbers. So what you get is the determinant of A. Well, there is a normalization by 2 pi, but if you normalize the measure by the correct factor, this comes out. So you get pi to the power n. You get the determinant of A, the matrix. And for anti-commuting numbers, I'm sorry, you get determinant of A minus 1, it's 1 over the determinant of A. This is the standard results of Gaussian integration over complex coordinates, that you get minus 1 instead of minus 1 half, because we are integrating over complex numbers instead of real numbers. And if we integrate over anti-commutative number, you get determinant instead of inverse of determinant. Okay. You get, let me rewrite it because that's important. Integral over d theta bar, integral over d theta, exponential of minus theta bar times the matrix times theta, the vector, is determinant of A. Okay. So let me give just some examples. Only 5 minutes. Okay, so for instance, if I have just n equal 1, the element here that I have here, if I have my matrix A is just A11, A12, A bar 12, and A22, where A and A bar are complex conjugate. But let me write this as A to 1. In fact, the result is going to be, even if the matrix is not Hermitian, that's up to some. Okay, so I'm assuming it's Hermitian. Then, of course, exponential of minus theta A times theta bar is just, you have just one theta and one theta bar. So this is exponential minus theta squared A11 plus theta bar A12 plus theta bar theta. I'm sorry. No, I'm very sorry. I'm sorry. I'm stupid. A is just one matrix with an element A. I'm sorry, real. So we are computing exponential of minus theta bar times theta times A, which is 1 minus A times theta bar theta. And when we integrate this d theta bar integral d theta of 1 minus A theta bar theta, this gives 0. This, we have to anti-commute the thetas and the theta bars. Then we get A, which is a determinant. Now, n equal 2, A is A11, A12, A21, and A22, exponential of minus theta bar A times theta is now exponential of minus theta bar 1 times theta 1 A11 minus theta bar 1 theta 2 A12 minus theta bar 2 theta 1 A21 minus theta bar 2 theta 2 A12, and I'm sorry, A22. And when you take the exponential of this, as you know, only you have to only to keep the term which is the square of this. And in the square of this, you only have to take the product of this term with this term and the product of this term of these terms, because all the other one contains the product of two times the same theta or the same theta bars. So this is some term that we don't like. And then you get the products of this with this two times with anti-commuting. So you get basically A11, A22 with a coefficient which is theta bar 1, theta 1 times theta bar 2. Theta 2 plus the product of this coefficient with this coefficient, you get A12 times A21 times theta bar 1 theta 2 times theta bar 2 theta 1. Okay, so these terms are going to give 0. And when you integrate now over d theta bar 1 d theta 1 d theta bar 2 d theta 2, you have to reorder the terms here. And you reorder, and you get that at the end when you integrate. You get A11, A22, minus A12, A21, because the number of, here you have to make an even number of anti-commutation. And here you have to make an odd number. So you get this, which is the determinant of this. You see how it works. Okay? So a general proof is a bit longer, but that's all what we need. Okay? So this is for Gaussian integrals. And now I want to define to see whether there is an analog of a Vick theorem for anti-commuting variables. So I want to compute now products, well, expectation value of G. So I want to compute expectation value of products of thetas and of theta bars defined in the following way. Defines as the Gaussian integrals of exponential of this, when now I put theta I and theta bar g. So this is still a complex number, because I integrate some element of the algebra multiplied by another element of the algebra, and I'm going to define an expectation value, so I divide by another complex number, which is the exponential of minus theta bar times a times theta. Okay, so this is a complex number divided by a complex number. Okay. Well, here, this is the determinant of the matrix. If you compute this, you expand the exponential. So you have a sum of products of theta bar, theta times matrix element of the A. But here, you have two additional thetas and theta bars. So in this new integral, only counts term where you have n minus 1 matrix elements instead of n. So you have a sum of products of n minus 1 elements. But still, with signs coming from the anti-commutation relation. So the final result is that what you get is a determinant of the minor matrix. You get the minor of the matrix A, but the IG minor of the matrix A divided by the determinant of the matrix A. That's the result of the calculation. And therefore, what you get is a matrix element of the inverse of AIG. You see? So this is the important result. So this object that you can call, if you want, the two point expectation value defined by this definition. It's just a ratio of this Grassmann integral by this Grassmann integral. It's just the inverse of the matrix. Yes?
What is exactly minor?
The minor, if you have a matrix M, A, big matrix A, the minor of the matrix A, the IG minor, is you take you take the row I, the column G. You remove this, you remove it, so you consider this submatrix. Okay. And the minor is up to a sign, which I think is minus I plus G, Well, in my definition of the minor, that's minus 1 I plus G times the determinant of the matrix A, where the row I and column G are removed. Okay? Yes?
The first equality is just the definition of the left-hand side object, right?
Pardon?
The first equality is just the definition.
Yeah, this is a definition. So define this. This is a definition. Yeah? Okay. We take this as a definition. And this is the result of the calculation. Result of the calculation. Okay. And going back to minor, it is known that the matrix element IG of the inverse of the matrix is the minor divided by the determinant. That's a classical result of matrix theory of linear algebra. A minus 1 IG is minor IG divided by determinant of the matrix. Okay. See your course of linear algebra. Okay. Okay, so you see that the Vick theorem for Grassmann numbers works as for complex number, because for complex number you had that Zi z bar g defined is a minus 1 ig as for real matrices. Here we have that theta I theta bar g is also a minus 1 ig. But now there is a difference. These anticommutes. So if you want to compute theta bar I theta g, this is not this element. This is minus a minus 1 ig. While here, they commute. Okay. And this one is not working. So now well, this goes on. Now, if you want to compute a four-point function, yes?
Those indices are backwards, right, for the theta I?
Pardon?
The indices for the theta I, theta j?
Yes.
Should they be the other way around?
Well, you can anticommute g and I. Yes. Then it's going to be minus m. No, but then it's going to be minus a bar minus 1 ig still. But since a is anti-symmetric, is a Hermitian, this is going to be the complex conjugate of ge, gi. Ah, so there, you mean there is going to be complex conjugation. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, in general, there is a complex conjugation. Yeah, I think so. So there is a typo in there. While here it should be with a plus. Yeah. Okay. So we can represent this, if you prefer, we can represent this as writing theta I theta bar g as a Dirac propagator, if you want, that goes from I to g. Okay, now you can continue to play the same rule, the same game, if you want to compute a four-point function. You want to compute theta I, theta bar g, theta k, theta bar l, defined exactly in the same way. Well, you can repeat the operation. Here you are going to have just the products of four n minus two a's divided by the products of a. And at the end of the game, you find that this is going to be theta I times theta bar g, with the expectation value of this times theta k theta bar l, minus theta I times theta bar L, expectation of this times the expectation value of theta K times theta bar G. Okay. Calculate, you find this. Which means that this object, where you have to pay attention to the order, can be represented as this line, I goes to G. Remember, you have to times K going to L minus this. For this four-point function, is just given by the sum of the products of two-point function, but with the minus signs, because there is a permutation which is different. You do the calculation. I don't have time to do the proof here, but the proof is elementary. So you get, for the four-point function, the same kind of signs that you get for the Wick theorem for fermions. So this is just the Wick theorem for Dirac field that you got in QFT1 course. Okay. And etc. If you want to play with a 2k point function, it works. Okay. So this formalism, which is just a way to compute determinants and to compute minors, has all the properties that one expects for what we would like to have for anti-commuting Dirac fields. So now, out of this formalism, very formal, we can work out, this is the second part of the calculation, of the discussion, a functional quantization for the Dirac field. So this is going to be very sketchy because I have only 15 to 20 minutes. And I'm not going to use that to do any calculation, but just to show you how one can define a functional integral. Define what are the correlation function and hope that you are convinced that by applying those rules, you get exactly the Feynman diagrammatic rules of Dirac fields in QED. Okay, so now, you know, in the Dirac field, for the Dirac field, okay. Okay, so I'm going to write, so you have a Dirac field psi. It is a collection of psi A of x with A goes from 1 to 4. That's a number of it in the dimension. Okay. And x belonging to Minkowski space, 1, 3. I'm going to walk in my Euclidean signature. So now in my signature, where the signature of space-time, h mu nu is minus 1, 1, 1. You have its complex conjugate, which is the psi bar, which is psi bar A of x with A equal 1 to 4. What do I need yet? You need the gamma matrices which satisfy the relation that gamma mu, gamma nu, and with my notation is going to be minus 2 h mu nu, because my h mu nu is the opposite of the one you had in your QFT one signature. Oh, hence you have the minus sign here. And you know that the Dirac equation can be written, the Dirac equation for this, which is I d slash minus m of psi equals 0, is of course d slash is gamma mu d over dx mu, comes from the Dirac action. Is it visible here? Maybe I should. This comes from the Dirac action. S of psi bar psi, which is integral d4x over Minkowski space of psi bar of x, I d slash minus m psi of x. Where this means that you sum over the, so this is of course a matrix. So you have to sum over the indices, the Dirac indices. So the A's 1, 4, 4 are Dirac indices, and the mu equal 1 to 4 are Lorentz indices. And the fact that in four-dimensional space-time you have as many Dirac indices and you have Lorentz indices is true only for d equal 4. Because in general, you have in general d, the integral part, is the number of Dirac indices in d-dimensional space-time. So in 2 and 3 dimensions, you have only 2 Dirac indices. In 4 and 5, you have 4, etc. Okay, so now, well, I prefer to have this written. So let's go to use the last blackboard here, since I cannot use This is a rear. Well, we can close that. So what do we need to do, to perform a functional integration? Okay. So I consider a very big Grassmann algebra. Let's call it G Dirac, whose generator are just all the components of the field. So instead of having some theta, the thetas, now the generator thetas are going to be called, so they are labeled instead of being labeled from I equal 1 to n. I consider now generators that I denote psi. I could have called them theta, but they are labeled by both a Dirac index and a space-time index. So the index are a, goes from 1 to 4, and x, so if you prefer, the index are ax, with a going from 1 to 4, and x a continuous index labeling points in Minkowski space. Okay? And in the same way, the theta bar I with I going from 1 to n becomes fields that I'm going to call psi bar Ax. Okay? And the same way. So now I have a very big Grassmann algebra, which is generated by this infinite number of generators. So it's infinite dimensional. But formally, it can be defined. Or if you replace your space-time by a finite lattice, then it becomes finite dimensional. You can make sense of this by going to a finite space-time lattice. Then it's finite dimensional. Okay? And then the action becomes just a quadratic form. We can consider now the action of Dirac, S Dirac, equal integral over Minkowski space, over all C space of psi bar A of X. So I gamma mu A, B, D over DX, mu minus M delta A, B of psi B of X, which is just a Dirac action written with all the components. This is a quadratic form. This is S Dirac of psi bar of psi, the quadratic form. It's the analog of this theta bar A theta. Okay? And therefore, we can write a functional integral, a Grassmann functional integral, simply as what I'm going to write is d formally as d of psi bar and psi exponential of I divided by h bar s Dirac of psi bar and psi. And this is just a Gaussian functional integral, which is analog to this one. Okay? And where here S Dirac is defined in this way, and formally with measure d of psi bar and psi is just formally a product over x. So it's an infinite product, so this requires. And then a product over A from 1 to 4, Dirac indices of the integral d psi bar A of x times d psi A of x. Okay, so this is. Okay. So this Grassmann functional integral, by the rule we are, is just going to be proportional to the determinant of the Dirac operator. Which, if you can make sense of it, for instance, by going to a lattice, is a perfectly well-defined number. Okay? And moreover, when you compute according to those rules, the two-point function, namely the expectation value of psi of x times pi psi bar of 2 points y. And so now this is a matrix because this depends on x, on y, on a, on some index a and b, Dirac indices. Then this is going to be simply, we know by the general theory, the matrix element of the inverse of the Dirac operator. So this is going to be the matrix element of the inverse between point x and point y. So this is going to be the Feynman propagator in the Dirac theory between point x and point I, which is given if you diagonalize everything to be going is d4p or d4k, well, d4p over 4 pi squared I over minus p slash plus m minus I epsilon plus e I p times x minus y. This is a matrix. And this should correspond in canonical quantization to the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of the fermionic operator psi. So this is an operator psi of x times psi of y. So this is where these are the field operator. And this is time ordering description product, which is for fermions, namely that you have to make anti-commuting the field operators. And this is psi and psi bar if y is in the future of x. So if you want to be sure, it's a bit, you need a bit of more, but basically this general property ensures that everything works. So you get this for the two, the propagator, the two-point function. Okay. And then, what should I say? I can say that, of course, from this rules, you get the usual Wick theorem for fermions with the correct sign when you consider a product of four fermionic Dirac operators. Okay. So everything works. So Wick theorem applies. Nice. You may also ask. I've wrote this in the Minkowski space, but is there a theory for Euclidean fermions? There is one, so you can define fermions in the Euclidean. And that's it. So you might have the impression that I've cheated, but because basically I just show that using those calculation rules, you can define a functional integral for fermions. And you just reobtain the usual quantization rule for fermions. So maybe you shouldn't have needed this formalism. But this way of thinking about the result of canonical quantization of fermions by this Grassmann functional integral is very convenient because it's a shortcut for many calculation by replacing a creation calculation using operator by calculation using just algebra and anti-commuting numbers. And moreover, it's useful in non-relativistic quantum systems involving fermions, so typically in condensed matter, where we have fermions with spin, etc. So they are not Dirac fermions, but they are fermions, condensed matter. What should I say? I wanted to say something else. Why this is important? Ah, yes. And finally, here I have treated the system of the Dirac free fermions. But if you have Dirac fermions that you quantize by this kind of Bayesian functional integral, yeah, because all this application has been done by Bayesian, and you couple it to electromagnetic field in order to get QED, and you quantize the electromagnetic field by ordinary functional integral. As we did for the bosonic field, the scalar field. So the only difference that I'm going to treat tomorrow is the gauge invariance. Then we get a perfectly well-defined and self-consistent functional integral. Which treats on the same footing the gauge field and the fermions, simply the fermions are described by anti-commuting fields, and the gauge field by commuting fields, but they are integrating over by the functional integrals that's at that level of treatment. Has exactly the same form. You have to integrate over the Dirac field, you have to integrate over the electromagnetic field, and you have the exponential of an action, where now the coupling between the fermion, I'm sorry, this is science, is treated exactly in the same way. Because once you have an action for this, the Dirac action, you can replace the d mu by d mu plus I, a mu with a and f. It remains a quadratic form from the fermions, but which depends on a mu, and everything works. Okay, so thank you. And tomorrow, we are going to start the discussion of quantization of the gauge field.